Coming up today on Davisville, he comes from Davis, and now he commands a ship. Well, good morning, good afternoon, or good evening, whenever you're listening. This is Davisville on KDRT-LP 95.7 FM in Davis, California. We live at kdrt.org online. I'm Bill Buchanan, and I thank you for tuning in. Well, of the different responsibilities that people have taken on after growing up in Davis, here's one you don't hear about too often, or maybe never before, becoming the commander of a U.S. Navy ship. Today's guest, however, has done just that. He's Ryan Easterday. He's commander of the USS John McCain, a destroyer that's part of the 7th Fleet and has its home port in Japan. Commander Easterday was back in his hometown for a few days in February and has come by Davisville today to talk about the Navy, his job, what he sees out there, and more. Commander, thanks for coming on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure there's a lot you can't talk about because you're a Navy officer, politics, for example, and I'm sure there's classified knowledge that we can't. But what I'd like to do today is to get as much of your candor insights into your job, as we can, into what you do and what the Navy does, as you can share. And I want to start with, I guess, a simple question about the McCain. It's a very basic question, but briefly, what is a destroyer, in terms of size and power and crew and purpose?
Destroyers actually were originally meant to be small, fast ships that operated outside the main battle line in the days of battleships in the early 20th century to scouts and to screen the force and to use torpedo attacks. They've evolved a lot over the last 100 years, and now the destroyer that I command is a 505-foot-long, 66-foot-wide, 9,000-ton piece of really complicated high-tech machinery that carries a broad range of sensors and weapon systems to engage in combat and execute the nation's missions on the sea.
And how big's your crew?
I have about between 310 and 330-odd sailors working for me on any given day. They do about 2 to 4 year tours, so every week there's about 10 people coming in and 10 people leaving. And the number fluctuates a little bit, but 300 plus folks.
Okay, and then as commander, obviously you're in charge of the whole thing, but particularly something that size, there's no way you're making most of the decisions. So what's the structure? I mean, who reports to you?
Now, I try to make as few decisions as possible, which ends up still being quite a lot every day. I have an executive officer who's my second in command, about 6 department heads, and they each kind of own about 80 or so people, and the whole crew kind of falls under one of them. So there's a supply officer, there's a weapons officer, a combat systems officer, a chief engineer. Mm-hmm. Imagine Star Trek, and that's kind of how it's organized.
Okay. And then who do you report to?
So I have a boss that's a squadron commander, and he owns a bunch of ships. And there's a whole Navy hierarchy, and the command and control arrangements are complicated and intricate, and I could spend a lot of time talking about them and make your head spin. But
I get a general sense out of this. I mean, you've got some executive officers responsible for certain operations that report to you. You mm-hmm. report to a person who basically commands a squadron of ships like yours, mm-hmm. yours, and I'm sure not all exactly like yours.
They're all pretty close. So the destroyers, all the destroyers in a strike group belong to the squadron commodore, and then he's one of several major commanders within a strike group, which is led by an admiral and usually headquartered on an aircraft carrier.
Okay. So you grew up in Davis. What drew you to the Navy?
It's hard to say. I think I watched too much Star Trek as a kid, uh-huh. and space exploration wasn't really in the cards. But I also, my parents gave me a copy of some Tom Clancy novels as a kid, and I heard about the Navy through reading The Hunt for Red October, and somehow the two of those kind of fused together into this idea of maybe giving the military and specifically the Navy a shot. This idea of commanding my own ship that I got from Star Trek kind of hung out in the back of my head and I guess wouldn't go away.
Yeah. Well, and you went to the Naval Academy, right?
I did.
And you graduated with a degree in history, I believe, right?
That's correct.
In 2002?
In 2001.
2001. Yeah. So obviously that's something you do very deliberately. I mean, no one just drifts their way into the academy. And
I am quite possibly the only person who ever did exactly that and just sort of drifted
in. Okay, now that sounds like a story.
This will sound coy, but I kind of applied to it on a lark without any serious intention of actually going there. By the time I was really applying for colleges, you know, I kind of thought this was probably not a thing I was going to do, but because it had been lurking in the back of my head for so long, I figured why not put an application in and just see what happens. In the end, after all of my college acceptance letters came in, and then more importantly, all of the financial aid packages came in, the options had narrowed down to actually going to the Naval Academy or going to UC Santa Cruz. I'm also possibly the only person who's ever had to make that decision.
I was going to say, that sounds like kind of, you know, polar opposites.
It really was. And Santa Cruz sounded like a lot of fun, and I knew I had a lot of friends who were going there. But ultimately, as I sat down, I thought, you know, Santa Cruz was going to be a logical progression of all the things I'd been doing here in Davis, and it was going to be as kind of comfortable and familiar as going off to college could be. And moving to Maryland and going to the United States Naval Academy sounded like moving to another planet, and it was. And I opted for that adventure and figured I could always come back here. But if I was going to do that, I needed to do it then.
I've not been to the academy, but from what I know of it, very disciplined, very rigorous.
Those are good adjectives.
You know, in a way that a UC campus, also quite accomplished, but they have a whole different, let's use a Davis word, very different vibe.
An extremely different vibe, for sure.
But you chose the Navy.
Yep. And honestly, I can't say I have any regrets about it. I mean, it was in a lot of ways a lot less fun than going to Santa Cruz would have been, I'm sure. But I got opportunities to do stuff there that I wouldn't have had anywhere else, and that was really neat.
Well, and you've clearly had a successful career. I mean, you're
so it seems, yeah.
Yeah. Well, so you've got about 20 years now, right?
Coming up, yeah.
So I want to talk a little bit about the McCain II, just the name of the ship. Your ship's been in service for 25 years.
That's right.
And it's actually named for three people.
That's correct.
And for John McCain Sr., who was a four-star admiral and World War II commander.
Mm-hmm.
John McCain Jr., also a four-star admiral and commander of the U.S. Pacific Command, commander of the U.S. Pacific Command during the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
And John McCain III, the late Arizona senator and the Republicans' nominee for president in 2008. These are all big names in U.S. naval history. That's not your family. You don't have to live up to it. But you're, you know, I don't know. What do you think as you command a ship named the McCain?
It's interesting. I mean, ships, we name most of our destroyers after, for lack of a better word, various sort of types of war heroes, right? They're mostly all named after people, Medal of Honor winners, illustrious naval heroes of the past. So they have names like Preble and Decatur, which are Farragut, which are historic Navy names, and also more recent sort of military heroes like John Finn and Rafael Peralta. John McCain is actually the third ship to carry that name. The first one was named after the senator's grandfather, actually while the middle McCain, if you will, was still an admiral in the Pacific. When this ship was built, it was named after both the senator's father and grandfather, and he was really only added to the ship's namesake this last summer, in kind of recognition of the family's contributions to the Navy and to the country over.
Yeah.
What is now, you know, 70 years and more of military service.
And you took command last summer, I believe, right?
That's correct.
In July of 2019.
Yep.
So when you and your ship are at sea, what are you looking for?
Looking for? Well, it depends on what it is that we're out there to do. Some mornings, I just enjoy walking up to the bridge and sitting in my chair on the bridge, drinking a cup of coffee, and looking out over at the shape of Mount Fuji rising up over the horizon with the snow cap glinting in the sun. And those are the moments that sort of remind me why I thought this job would be a good idea sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
On a more serious note, the operations that the ship conducts, you know, supports defense of American interests abroad, right? We're demonstrating our commitments, our defense agreements with our friends and allies. We're supporting regional stability in the Western Pacific is notionally where we operate most of the time on my ship. We're protecting a free and open Indo-Pacific and protecting the sea lanes for trade, you know?
So is it then that you're looking for things that basically don't fit that mission? In other words, you're looking for something that looks suspicious or unusual or something to investigate?
That normally, that's not really how we operate. I mean, a lot of what we're doing is simply just providing presence. In some ways, not to overwork the policing metaphor, but, you know, we're like a police car driving around showing the flag. And that, in some ways, the simple visual cue of seeing us there and knowing that we are there, providing the security guarantee that the United States has provided since the end of World War II that has underpinned the stability and prosperity around the world, the ability for our morning coffee to make it from wherever it's being mm-hmm. grown overseas to our morning cup here in California, that simple act of presence, whether you're calling it deterrence or simply just reassurance that we're defending the international norms that have underpinned that stability.
I suppose in a way that's when it works best, isn't it? When your presence is sufficient to remove any need for you to do anything terribly.
For sure.
Active.
Winning without fighting is best, as some ancient Chinese philosopher said, I think.
There was a writer who lived in Davis for a while, William Langewisch, a first-rate nonfiction writer. And he wrote a book on modern piracy 17 years ago. I'd like to read part of this and just get your thoughts on what he says.
Sure.
This isn't about the Navy now, per se. It's just about being out on the sea. He says, the oceans increasingly are beyond government control. For public consumption in cities like London and Washington, D.C., there are still brave words about the promise of technology and the taming of the sea. Privately, though, the officials who are charged with doing the work, whether imposing navigational and safety standards on ships or fighting seaborne terrorism and criminality, now admit that unlike land or air, the sea is a domain that can barely be policed. This is neither a lament nor a forecast of doom, but a close observation of the ocean in our time. The ocean is our world, and it is wild. And, of course, he's particularly talking there, I think, about, you know, being out in the open sea, mm-hmm. Not so much along shorelines and such, where I guess you could say the rule of law is more established.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's an interesting take. Certainly there is simply too much space, as crowded as the oceans have become, and they're becoming increasingly crowded as population increases and as global maritime trade increases. 70% of the Earth is water, right? And that's an incredibly enormous amount of open space that no matter how many Navy ships there are, we can't, police them all and have control. I mean, that idea of control is itself kind of misguided, I think. But there is absolutely a legal framework that covers the seas. You know, the coastal nations have a 12-mile territorial sea. Outside of that, the high seas are free and open under international law. They provide a maritime commons that is a giant open highway for international commerce, right? One of the things that the navies of the world and that, kind of led by the United States try to do is to police that commons and make sure that merchant ships can travel without fear of being harassed or attacked. Piracy is a thing that's been a problem for hundreds of years, and navies for hundreds of years have been trying to combat it. It has its genesis on land, like almost everything. The Earth is 70% water, but 80% of the population lives on the coast. 90% of trade travels by sea. So,
okay. Yeah, listening to you, I get a sense of the cooperation between the countries on the sea. That's part of it, too, right? Is obviously, you have your job as commander of a U.S. Navy ship, mm-hmm. U.S. interests, and so on. But out there on the sea, it's a bit of cooperative effort to keep things flowing.
Absolutely. I mean, we have partners and allies all around the world. We have we work closely with almost all of the nations that conduct maritime commerce.
Yeah. So we'll do a station break. This is KDRT. The show is Davisville. I'm Bill Buchanan, and we are talking with Ryan Easterday. He is commander of the USS John McCain. He's here on Davisville because he grew up in Davis. So I wanted to talk about a couple of deployments you've had in your career. This is part of your official list.
Sure.
And you've done quite a few things in your career, but two struck me as examples that perhaps of the work of the Navy, and I wondered what you could tell us about each. The first was humanitarian relief operations that you and, of course, many, many others provided in the aftermath of the December 2004 South Asian tsunami. This is the one that struck Indonesia and Thailand and other countries, mm-hmm. and it killed more than 225,000 people. And so you were there afterwards, along with the Navy, providing some relief. Mm-hmm. What did you see? What did you do?
That deployment was one of the most fascinating and memorable experiences I've ever had, for sure. At the time, I was working with a sort of small boat team that was designed to do security operations. It was set up in the aftermath of the USS Cole bombing in Aden in 2000 to provide the Navy a sort of organic capability to protect ships in port from things like that.
Yeah, that's when a U.S. ship was bombed in the Persian Gulf, was it?
In a port in Yemen.
Port in Yemen, yeah.
So that unit was stationed in Guam, and when after the South Asian tsunami of 2004, we deployed a hospital ship. The Navy has two hospital ships, one on each coast. They're really designed to take wounded troops, and they have a bunch of ORs, and they embark a bunch of medical people to do surgical work on battlefield casualties. But they were kind of repurposed to do disaster relief as well. So after that tsunami, they got the ship underway from San Diego, sent it across to Indonesia. They picked us up along the way. Really, my job was sort of providing security for the Navy medical folks, and they actually embarked a bunch of volunteer doctors and nurses from an organization called Project Hope. And we spent the next 4 or 5 months doing humanitarian relief in Aceh province in northern Sumatra after the tsunami, and then after a second earthquake a few months later down in an island called Nias, a little further south. It was the scale of devastation was really unfathomable.
Yeah, I've seen photos, and of course just the numbers are arresting.
Yeah,
I can only imagine being in the middle of it. You know, as real and as vivid as it can seem to read about it or see the photos, being in the middle of it must have been...
For sure. There were years afterwards when I could still smell the smells just by looking at photographs.
Yeah.
Just imagine an entire chunk of the ocean just being picked up and then dropped on a city for miles and miles.
And I guess part of the point here, at least pertinent to this conversation, is this is something the Navy does.
It sure is. We spent months just basically providing help to people. It was really interesting for me. I mean, I was a very young officer. I'd been in the Navy about 3 years at that point after graduating from the academy. And it was my first real experience really engaging with a completely different culture. That part of Indonesia had a kind of ongoing low-level civil war for a lot of years. One of the things that just absolutely impressed me was the way that in the aftermath of the disaster, all of that just stopped. All the conflict stopped immediately. There was this intense outpouring of mutual aid and cooperation. Part of the reason I had been brought along on that and my team of security people had been brought along was because there was some concern about the safety of the people we were putting ashore to do relief efforts. It turned out those concerns were almost completely unfounded.
People were glad to see the relievers there.
People were very happy to have us. They were, there were still a lot of people with weapons around, but they weren't using them. You know, they were okay. People were rebuilding houses. They were evacuating people to get medical aid. It was a really impressive thing to be part of, and I was really proud of the help that we were able to provide a lot of people.
The second mission deployment, I'm not quite sure what the right word is to use here, that you listed here was when you were aboard the USNS Stockholm, Fred Stockholm, conducting counterterrorism operations in support of Joint Special Operations Task Force Philippines. So that's kind of dry language, but basically I read that as you were in there helping the Philippine government, I suppose?
We were working in cooperation with the Philippine government, doing counterterrorism. This was I was still working with the same sort of security unit, and we were doing the more, aggressive end of the spectrum of our operations. So where we'd been primarily doing disaster relief in Indonesia, there in the Philippines, we were looking for bad guys. We did actually do some humanitarian aid along the way, but the primary mission there was a little more pointy.
Yeah, and again, this gets into territory. There's probably things you can't talk about, but you know, tell us what you can about what that mission was. I mean, what were you going ashore? Was it more electronic surveillance? Just trying to get a picture of.
Essentially, we were part of a larger organization that was trying to identify specific people that we thought were doing things that weren't good, positioning to essentially capture them if they presented themselves in a place where we could get them. In the end, we did a lot of training for that mission. We didn't actually do any of it for real. And a lot of what we ended up day-to-day doing was just a lot of driving around doing logistical support. But that was part of the broader effort during those years to disrupt and degrade international terrorist organizations. Yeah.
We've got about 5 minutes left. I did want to ask a couple of questions that are sort of Davis flavored. And one of them is, I guess, you know, you grew up in Davis. Davis has its own sort of identity. I'm sure you know it pretty well. Mm-hmm. You've been in the Navy now a while. What did growing up in Davis, how did that influence your experiences as a naval officer?
It has influenced it profoundly, but in ways that I would probably struggle to really describe. In a sense, I carry a little bit of Davis around with me everywhere I go in the Navy. And I probably have a little bit of a reputation as a kind of iconoclast within the service.
Davis isn't a military town. It's a college town.
You're right.
There are a lot of veterans who live here, a lot of people who have served, but I mean, it's not Fairfield west of us, Travis Air Force Base. You're not surprised there to find people from there going to the military. But in Davis?
To some extent, I think I had a conscious desire to kind of break the stereotype in both directions, perhaps. Yeah. It's been fun coming back here and kind of putting a bit of a human face on an organization that can seem kind of monolithic and inhuman, perhaps.
I want to ask the question the other way, too. Having been in the Navy, having seen what you've seen, worked alongside the people you've worked along, how does that affect your view of Davis?
I had the chance to speak to some students at Donald High School at DHS yesterday morning. And, one of the things I told them is, you know, my crew on my ship in Japan is a majority-minority crew. My crew looks like America, honestly, in a way that Davis kind of doesn't.
Yeah.
And my sailors come from every walk of life. They come from every state in the Union. Some of them are not even U.S. citizens. Many of them come from extraordinarily disadvantaged backgrounds. It's been a real exercise in diversity, participating in this organization in a way that I think a lot of folks here might not expect, and And so it's really been a fun opportunity in both ways to kind of be a bridge between those two worlds and find the chinks in the armor, if you will.
Yeah, it's interesting you say that, I think, because, you know, military fighting in the name of democracy, obviously there has to be some kind of real connection between the public and the military.
Absolutely.
And so when I hear you talking about sort of bridging a gap, you know, bringing a different element to the military, and then likewise bringing the military back to a town that maybe otherwise might seem sort of indifferent to it, I think that's constructive.
Absolutely. I think so too.
So we got just about a minute left. What's sort of a surprise? What do you want people in Davis to know about the military that they don't know? Maybe about the Navy in particular, because, you know, we're not a coastal town here.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, America has always had a Navy, except for a very brief period after the Revolutionary War when we decided we didn't need it and then found out very quickly that actually we did and it was worth the cost. It is expensive, and it does a lot of things, and a lot of things that I think people are not paying attention to or even aware of, and it really does has been a critical part of the security guarantee that the United States has underwritten for the whole world, and it has benefited a lot of countries, not just us.
Okay. We're very near the end, but when you say a lot of things people may not know about, are there just one or two you could state real quickly that would?
Gosh, you know, you're putting me on the spot, and I had a hard time coming up with a specific example. But
well, in a way, you answered the question when you said security, but I didn't.
Yeah,
know if
I mean, simply that forward deployment, that forward presence, that readiness to engage in everything in the whole range of military operations, from humanitarian assistance and disaster relief all the way up to high-end, you know, real maritime combat when and if required, provides a deterrent effect and provides support and reassurance to our friends and allies around the world, and really makes the prosperity that we sort of rely on and may not always appreciate possible.
Yeah. Do you get back to Davis often?
I try to get back here at least about every year or two. I still have friends and family in town. My brother's a firefighter in Davis.
Okay.
And my in-laws live out in West Plainsfield, so there's always a good excuse to come visit.
All right. Well, we've been talking with Ryan Easterday, commander of the USS John McCain. Commander Ryan, thanks for coming into Davisville today.
Thank you very much. Thanks for hosting.
We are going to go out with had to choose a sort of an ocean song for this. It's called Sail Away by Brian Wilson, Al Jardine, and Blarney Chaplin, about half the Beach Boys. I'm Bill Buchanan. This is Davisville. Thanks for listening.
So many years ago, but I remember a distant sunset on the open sea. Fascinated by the sailing ships on a crimson shore that seemed to call out to me. I still can feel the hope that fills my heart. I still can taste the ocean.